vanquish into the yard. I didn't much mourn the loss of Burke or the demise of our wedding. I felt little heartbreak. Was that not strange? I did cry buckets, but mostly from the shame of it all. I didn't break my seclusion again. Instead, I took refuge in it. Almost daily I received notes of concern in flowery scripts. I was being prayed for by everyone imaginable. It was hoped my reputation wouldn't suffer too much. Did I know that Burke had vacated the city and was staying indefinitely with his uncle in Columbia? Wasn't it a shame that his mother had taken ill with apoplexy? How was my own mother bearing up? I was missed at tea, but my absence was commended. I shouldn't despair, for surely a young man would come forth who wouldn't be put off by my disgrace. I wrote rants and rebukes in my diary, then tore them out and burned them along with all the supercilious notes. Gradually, the lava in me subsided, and there remained only a young woman whose life course had been demolished. Unlike Handful, I had no notion what path to walk. 1 month after Charlotte's disappearance, a frigid wind brought down most of the leaves on the oak. Handful still walked obsessively each morning, but only a quick loop or so now. The week before, Mother had put a stop to her unremitting march and sent her back to her duties. The high social season, with its quota of gowns, awaited. All the sewing now fell to Handful. Charlotte was gone. No one believed she was coming back. I'd managed to stretch my 3 weeks of seclusion into four, but on this day, my reprieve ended. Mother had ordered me back to my duties as well, procuring a husband. She'd informed me that a rowboat traversing the Atlantic might eventually be rescued by a passing ship, but only if the rowboat bravely set out upon the water. This, her hapless metaphor of my marital prospects. My sister Mary arrived with similar encouragement. "Lift your chin, Sarah. Behave as if nothing has happened. Be gay and act assured. You'll find a husband, God willing." God willing. How strangely that strikes me now. On the evening my solitude ended, I shoved myself out into the public domain by attending a lecture at the Second Presbyterian Church, delivered by the Reverend Henry Colick, a famed preacher. Those were not the waters Mother had in mind. The Episcopal Church might pass for society, but certainly not the Presbyterians with their revivalism and shouts for repentance. But she didn't object. I was at least rowing, wasn't I? Sitting in a pew beside the devout friend who'd invited me, I scarcely listened at first. Words, sin, moral degradation, retribution, flitted in and out of my awareness. But at some point during that hour, I became morbidly engrossed. The Reverend's eyes found me. I can't explain it, nor did he look away as he spoke.
"Are you not sick of the frivolous being you have become? Are you not mortified at your own folly, weary of the ballroom and its gilded toys? Will you not give up the vanities and gaieties of this life for the sake of your soul?"
I felt utterly spoken to, and in the most direct and supernatural way. How could he know what lay inside me? How did he know what I was only that moment able to see myself?
"God calls you,"
he bellowed.
"God, your beloved, begs you to answer."
The words ravished me. They seemed to break down some great artifice. I sat on the pew quietly shaken, while Reverend Colick looked at me now without focus or interest. And perhaps it had been so all along, but it didn't matter. He'd been God's mouthpiece. He'd delivered me to the precipice where one's only choice was between paralysis or abandon. With the Reverend praying a long, earnest prayer for our souls, I took my leap. I vowed I would not return to society. I would not marry. I would never marry. Let them say what they would. I would give myself to God. 2 weeks later, on my 20th birthday, I entered the drawing room, where the family had gathered to offer me well wishes, accompanied by Nina, who clung to my hand. Seeing that I'd chosen to wear one of my simpler dresses and no jewelry, Mary smiled at me sadly as if I wore the costume of a nun. I gathered Mother had confided my religious conversion to my sisters, perhaps to my father and brothers as well. Aunt Sister had baked my favored dessert, a two-tiered election cake, filled with currants and sugar. Such cakes were molded on a board with yeast and left to rise, if they so elected, and this one had done so with majesty. Nina pranced about it impatiently until Mother signaled Aunt Sister to cut the slices. Father was seated with my brothers, who were engaged in a debate of some sort. Edging to the fringes, I determined that Thomas had evoked their wrath by promoting a program known as colonization. From what I could gather, the term had little to do with the British occupation of the last century and everything to do with the slaves. What's this concept? I asked, and they turned to me as if a housefly had pried through a slat in the shutters and was buzzing wantonly about.
It's a new and advanced idea, Thomas answered. Despite what any of you believe, it will soon expand into a national movement. Mark my words.
But what is it? I said.
It proposes we free the slaves and send them back to Africa.
Nothing had prepared me for so radical a scheme.
Why, that's preposterous.
My reaction took them by surprise. Even Henry and Charles, now 13 and 12, gaped at me.
Christ preserve us, said John. Sarah is against it.
He assumed I'd outgrown my rebellions and become like the rest of them, a guardian of slavery. I couldn't fault him for it. When was the last time any of them had heard me speak out against the peculiar institution? I'd been wandering about in the enchantments of romance, afflicted with the worst female curse on earth, the need to mold myself to expectations. John was laughing. A fire raged on the grate, and Father's face was bright and sweating. He wiped at it and joined the mirth.
Yes, I am against colonization, I began.
There was no falter now in my throat. I forced myself to keep on.
I'm against it, but not for the reason you think. We should free the slaves, but they should remain here, as equals.
An odd intermezzo ensued, during which no one spoke. There'd been mounting talk from certain clergy and pious women about treating slaves with Christian sympathy, and now and then some rare soul would speak of freeing the slaves altogether.
But equality? Ludicrous.
By law, a slave was 3/5 of a person. It came to me that what I'd just suggested would seem paramount to proclaiming vegetables equal to animals, animals equal to humans, women equal to men, men equal to angels. I was upending the order of creation. Strangest of all, it was the first time thoughts of equality had entered my head, and I could only attribute it to God, with whom I'd lately taken up, and who was proving to be more insurrectionary than law-abiding.
My goodness, did you learn this from the Presbyterians? Father asked. Are they saying slaves should live among us as equals?
The question was sarcastic, meant for my brothers and for the moment itself. Yet I answered him. No, Father, I'm saying it. As I spoke, a rush of pictures spilled through my mind, all of them handful. She was tiny, wearing the lavender bow on her neck. She was filling the house with smoke. She was learning to read. She was sipping tea on the roof. I saw her taking her lash, wrapping the oak with stolen thread, bathing in the copper tub, sewing works of pure art, walking bereaved circles. I saw everything as it was.
Handful. Mama was gone, sure as I'm sitting here, and I couldn't do a thing but walk the yard trying to siphon my sorrow. The sorry truth is, you can walk your feet to blisters, walk till kingdom come, and you never will outpace your grief. Come December, I stopped all that. I halted in my track by the woodpile where we used to feed the little owl way back then, and I said out loud, "Damn you for saving yourself. How come you left me with nothing but to love you and hate you, and that's gonna kill me, and you know it is." Then I turned round, went back to the cellar room, and picked up the sewing. Don't think she wasn't in every stitch I worked. She was in the wind, and the rain, and the creaking from the rocker. She sat on the wall with the birds and stared at me. When darkness fell, she fell with it. One day, before they started the days of Christmas in the house, I looked at the wood trunk on the floor, shoved behind Mama's gunny sack. I said, "Now where'd you go and put the key?" I had got where I talked to her all the time. Like I would say, I didn't hear her talk back, so I hadn't lost my sanities. I turned the room upside down and the key was nowhere. It could have been in her pocket when she went missing. We had an axe in the yard shed, but I hated to chop the trunk apart. I said, "If I was you, where would I hide the key that locked up the only precious things I had?" I stood there a while. Then I lifted my eyes to the ceiling, to the quilt frame. The wheels on the pulley were fresh with oil. They didn't make a peep when I brought down the frame. Sure enough, the key was laying in a groove along one of the boards. Inside the trunk was a fat bundle wrapped in muslin. I peeled back the folds and you could smell Mama, that salty smell. I had to take a minute to cry. I held her quilt squares against me, thinking how she said they were the meat on her bones. There were 10 good-sized squares. I spread them out across the frame. The colors she'd used outdid God and the rainbow. Reds, purples, oranges, pinks, yellows, blacks, and browns. They hit my ears more than my eyes. They sounded like she was laughing and crying in the same breath. It was the finest work ever to come from Mama's hands. The first square showed her Mama standing small, holding her Mama and Daddy's hands, and the stars falling around them. That was the night my granny Mama got sold away, the night the story started. The rest was a hodgepodge. Some squares I could figure, some I couldn't. There was a woman hoeing in the fields. I guessed her to be my granny Mama too, wearing a red headscarf and a baby. My Mama was laying in the growing plants. Slave people were flying in the air over their heads, disappearing behind the sun. Next one was a little girl sitting on a three-leg stool, appliquing a quilt, red with black triangles, some of the triangles spilling on the floor. I said, "I guess that's you, but it could be me." Fourth one had a spirit tree on it, with red thread on the trunk, and the branches were filled with vultures. Mama had sewed a woman and baby boy on the ground. You could tell it was a boy from his privates. I figured they were my granny Mama when she died and her boy that didn't make it. Both were dead and picked bloody. I had to walk out in the cold air after that one. You come from your Mama, you sleep in the bed with her till you're near 20 years grown, and you still don't know what haunches in the dark corners of her. I came back inside and studied the next one. It had a man in the field. He had a brown hat on, and the sky was full of eyes sitting in the clouds, big yellow eyes and red rain falling from the lids. That man is my daddy, Shaney, I said to myself. One after that was Mama and a baby girl stretched on the quilt frame. I knew that girl was me, and our bodies were cut in pieces, bright patches that needed piecing back. It made my head sick and dizzy to look at it. Another square was Mama sewing a wild purple dress covered with moons and stars, only she was doing it in a mouse hole, the walls bent over her. Going picture to picture, felt like I was turning pages in a book she left behind, one that held her last words. Somewhere along the way, I stopped feeling anything. Like when you lay on your arm wrong and you wake up and it's pins and needles. I started looking at the appliques that had taken Mama 2 years to sew like they didn't have any belonging to me, because that was the only way I could bear to see them. I let them float by like panes of light. Here was Mama with her leg hitched up behind her with a strap standing in the yard getting the one-legged punishment. Here was another spirit tree, same like the other one, but it was ours. And it didn't have vultures, only green leaves and a girl underneath with a book and a whip coming down to strike her. Last square was a man, a bull of a man with a carpenter apron on, Mr. Denmark Vesey. And next to him, she'd stitched four numbers big as he was, 1884. I didn't have a notion what that meant. I went straight to stitching, hell with Mrs. and her gowns. All that day and far in the night, I pieced Mama's squares together with the tiny stitches you can't barely see. I sewed on the lining and filled the quilt with the best padding we saved and the whole collection of our feathers. Then I took shears to my hair and cut every bit of it off my head down to a scalp of fuzz. I loosed the cut hair all through the stuffing. That's when I remembered about the money. 8 years saving. I went over and looked down in the trunk and it was empty as air. $400. Gone, same as Mama. And I'd run out of places to look. I couldn't draw a breath. Next day, after I'd slept a little, I sewed the layers of the quilt together with a tacking stitch. Then I wrapped the finished quilt round me like a glory cloak. I wore it out into the yard where Aunt Sister was bundled up chopping cane sugar, and she said, "Girl, what you got on you? What'd you do to your head?" I didn't say nothing. I walked back to the tree with my breath trailing clouds, and I wrapped new thread round the trunk. Then the noise came into the sky. The crows were flying over and smoke from the chimneys rising to meet them. "There you go," I said. "There you go." Part 3, October 1818 to November 1820. Handful. Some days I'd be coming down East Bay and catch sight of a woman with cinnamon skin slipping around a corner, a snatch of red scarf on her head, and I'd say, "There you are again." I was 25 years old and still talking to her. Every October, on the anniversary day of Mama gone missing, us slaves sat in the kitchen house and reminisced on her. I hated to see that day come dragging round. On the 6-year mark, Benna patted my leg and said, "Yo, Mama gone, but we still here. The sky ain't falling yet." "No, but..." Every year, one more slat got knocked out from under it. That evening, they dredged up stories on Mama that went on past supper, stealing the bolt of green cloth, hoodwinking Mrs. with her limp, wrangling the cellar room, getting herself hired out, that whole Jesus act she did. Tomfrey told about the time Mrs. had him search the premise and Mama was nowhere on it, how we slipped her in the front door to the roof, then trumped up that story about her falling asleep there. Same old tales, same laughing and slapping. Now that she was gone, they loved her a lot better. "You sure do have her eyes," Goodis said. looking at me moon-faced like he always did. I did have her eyes, but the rest of me had come from my daddy. Mama said he was an undersized man and blacker than the backside of the moon. On my sake, they left out the stories of her pain and sorrow. Nothing about what might have happened to her. Every one of them, even Goodis, believed she'd run and was living the high life of freedom somewhere. I could more easily believe she'd been on the roof all this time sleeping. Outside, the day was fading off. Tomfrey said it was time to light the lamps in the house, but nobody moved. And I felt the ache for them to know the real woman Mama was. Not just the cunning one, but the one smelted from iron, the one who paced the nights and prayed to my granny mama. Mama had yearned.